talk this evening, his brotherhood apprenticeships. Yes, this has to do with the second object of the Theosophical Society, that is, to have a comparative study of world religions, ancient and modern, and philosophies, and to demonstrate the importance of such studies. But it is only a natural corollary of the first object of the society, namely to establish a nucleus for universal brotherhood, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition or organization. This gives us that unity of everything in nature. Therefore, in that unity, you must find a source for all religions. Now naturally, therefore, we are taking up the subject today, the brotherhood of religions. When you look around, what do we see today? It's really saddening indeed, especially in India. It's been a land of strife, strife between two communities, between Muslims and Hindus. We had the unfortunate Ayodhya episode, then we had the riots in Bombay, then we had the massacre in Surat. It is the two communities, and almost every year there's a massacre going on in Bivandi. All in the name of religion. And then we have the other kinds of strife zones too, between Sikhs and non-Sikhs, between Naidus and Mudaliyars in the south in Coimbatore. And in the west we have, again, between, yes, even in India we have the struggle, the strife between Hindus and Christians nowadays, unfortunately. And then in the west we have the wars and strife between two sects of Islam, Sufi and Sunni. Then we have also the crusades fought in the name of religion between Christians and Muslims. All over the world, yes, this religion has been a bugbear. It's a destructive force. It's really saddening indeed. But really, if religion has to survive, the true religion really means that binding force which unites man to man. But what happens today? Religion means, yes, religious bigotry, fanaticism, kills people. It's man, inhumanity to man. Now we call it a very enlightened civilization. And it's any civilization which allows such mutually contradictory, conflicting, antagonistic religions to survive can be called really great civilization. As you said earlier, you see, religion is a binding force which unites man to man. If religion is going to divide man from man, then what happens? It is unable to express the truth of the spirit in man. It is only an expression of a destructive force. And really, if you allow such religions to survive, then it's only the hotbed, where the mother source, the source of enmity, jealousy, ill will, and bloodshed also, that we have seen everywhere. But if you go to various religions and find out historically speaking, then you will find the great teachers of mankind have come time and time again to reiterate the same old doctrine. Sometimes stressing metaphysics, sometimes mostly ethics, depending upon the climate, the mind of people, etc. But none of them, no one of them, has founded any religion. For instance, Buddha came 2,500 years back, and he was a Hindu Kshatriya, born in Kshatriya family. And he gave the most wonderful ethical teaching to reform decaying Brahmanism. He never founded any religion. Likewise, the great Tirthankaras who were there, they never founded any religion. They were reiterating the same old Brahmavidya time and time again. And Jesus himself was a Jew belonging to the sect of Essenes. He came to reform Judaism. In fact, he goes on to say in the Bible that he has not come to even to change the tithe of the Torah. He came to uphold the Torah. Torah means law. And then he never said, he always said, love thy neighbor as thyself. He never said, love thy Christian neighbor. He only said, love thy neighbor as thyself. And yet, today what do we see? Christianity makes Christ or Jesus as the only Son of God. Can we accept such a principle, such a statement, that he is the only Son of God? Then what do you find in Islam or Quran? And they talk about, yes, brotherhood, Islamic brotherhood. Can there be any brotherhood which excludes other people? What crimes have they committed? Can there be partial brotherhood, which is parochial, which unfortunately the fundamentalists hold on to? And then in fact, the Prophet Muhammad only talked about moderation regarding with other religions. We don't have time to go to all that. The point is, in spite of that, the Islamic fundamentalists say that Muhammad was the greatest prophet on earth. So it's the case with other things. Zarathustra talked about the path of purity. The path of purity alone can lead one to peace and enlightenment. What do we do? Fire temple is only meant for pastors. Do they understand the meaning of fire? That man himself is called an agrihotri, holder of fire. If only we understand the true meaning of all these things, would we hold on to these things, dogmas and superstitions? But unfortunately, say man is driven by the blind faith to hold on to whatever religion he is born in. Just because a man happens to be born in a Brahmin family, does he become a Brahmin? Any more than a Christian who is born in a Christian family can be called a Christian. A Brahmin is one who has realized the Brahman within. He is able to see the Brahman everywhere, even in a miniature. Today, what do we do? Even today, there is a war going on between Dalits and non-Dalits. All based on this communal caste system. It's all man-made. In fact, if you go to Bhagavad Gita, read them properly, you will find Varnashra Dharma was man-made. The Varnashra Dharma originally meant according to disposition of the people, the qualities of people, the profession they were undertaking. A teacher was called a Brahmin. A person who is doing business, trading, is called a Vaishya. A person who is of a warrior, belongs to warrior caste, is called a Kshatriya, etc., etc. But unfortunately, man, who has made all these divisions, these man-made divisions have to go. But Theosophy points out there is a mother source, which is of a divine origin. From one source, all these religions have branched off. From one white light of truth, which when passing through a glass prism, splits into seven colors. Each one is trying to call itself unique. This whole problem. Now what happens is, see, when you are able to see for the divine origin, it is stated that, see, all the religions are true at the bottom. False at the surface, covered over with cobwebs, dogma, superstition. Therefore there are two extremes. Instead of taking the middle path, one group of people say, look here, since it is true at the bottom, we will try to adopt all the forms and rituals of all religions. But where it will lead us? It will ultimately lead us to lunacy. We might land up in lunatic asylum. The other extreme is, yes, because it is false at the bottom, or the top, surface, corrupt the surface, we will throw off everything. That will lead us to spiritual insolvency and spiritual suicide. Theosophy points out, look, there must be mother source from which everything has come. And we just try it, and Theosophy agrees with what we have in the Mahabharata. In the Karna Parva, Dharma is defined. Dharma is defined as that which upholds, which sustains, dhara. That is, to hold, to uphold. To hold together all people together. Is to hold people together. And there we find that religion, true religion, is the binding force par excellence. Now let's see what Theosophy has to say. The very word Theosophy comes from the Greek word Theosophia, and it's defined beautifully in the glossary by H.P. Blavatsky. She points out it's a Greek word meaning wisdom, religion, or divine wisdom. The substratum and basis. Here itself we have the clue. The mother of all religions. The substratum and basis of all the world religions and philosophies. Taught and practiced by a few elect ever since man became a thinking being. Please note this. Ever since man became a thinking being. In its practical bearing, Theosophy is purely divine ethics. This is important. That is knowledge, spiritual knowledge, has been there with man ever since he acquired the manas at 3.5 rounds of our revolutionary period. If you go to the Secret Doctrine, volume 1, page 207, 208, it's clearly indicated that in the early part of the third race, sons of fire and mist were created, the sons of will and yoga, who incarnated in man. And in the other portion of third race, great sages and rishis of prayer rounds incarnated. And these great exalted spiritual beings formed and founded the nursery for human, future human adults. And it is the great exalted spiritual beings that who inform or who instructed infant mankind in their arts and sciences and spiritual knowledge under the guidance of Mahadeva, the great Shiva, the yogi of yogis. It's very clearly indicated. And what do we have in our reading today? Wonderful. It gives us a source. See here. This exhaustive doctrine of yoga I formerly taught unto Vivastha. Vivastha stands for Manu, the first divine manifestation, son. Vivastha communicated to Manu, and Manu made it known unto Ikshvaku. And being thus transmitted from one unto another, it was studied with the Radharishis. Until at length in the course of time, the mighty art was lost, who harassed thy force. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated with thee. That means how the great doctrine has been promulgated time and time again. In the course of time it gets lost, and then again. But first, at the beginning of manifestation, the first human race, it was taught by the divine being. And to whom? To son, divine manifestation. See what Mr. Judge has to say in the commentary on the fourth chapter. He says, Vivaswata is the name for the son. And after him came Manu and his son with Ikshvaku. The latter founded the line of solar kings, who in early times in India were men of supreme knowledge. Although Vivaswata as a name for the sun reveals nothing to our Western ears, there is a great truth hidden behind it. Just as today, there is a great mystery behind our solar arm. He was the being appointed to help and guide the race at its beginning. He had himself ages before gone through incarnation during other creations and had mounted step by step up the long ladder of evolution until by natural right he had become as a god. The same process is going on today, preparing some being for similar work in ages to come. It has gone on this limitless path also, and always the Supreme Spirit of Krishna teaches the being so that he may implant those ideas necessary for our salvation. It means the whole spiritual knowledge of man, his nature and his destiny, the soul, has been taught to the infant humanity by great exalted spiritual beings like Krishna. Elsewhere, this Prabhupada Vyasa clearly indicates that at the beginning of a great human race, the Manasaputras and the Kumaras descend upon earth as avatars in order to instruct mankind. And this they do at the junction of two great cycles, or at the junction of one great cycle and a small cycle, at the beginning of every human race. Now what happens is, they impart to man all the knowledge, spiritual knowledge. But and disappear from the scene after striking the keynote, but the vibration they have set reverberates throughout the cycle. Now what happens is, man becomes more and more animalized and materialized, these truths were made to fade away from human memory. But yet, he has retained some of the innate ideas as eternal verities. One such innate idea is the instinctive feeling of religious feeling. See, the religious instinct is one of the most forceful of human instincts. By the aid of right knowledge, man can press that instinct into his own service and so can secure for himself the peace and enlightenment and become instrumental in bringing that inner peace of conviction and of faith to his fellow men. He becomes in turn a teacher to other people. Now, let's see some of the definitions given by Theosophy, by HPP on Theosophy, which clearly indicates that it's a mother source. The wisdom religion was one in antiquity, and the same as the primitive religions, religious philosophy is proven to us by the identical doctrines taught to the initiates during the mysteries, an institution once universally diffused. All the old worships indicate the existence of a single theosophy anterior to them. The wisdom religion was ever once, and being the last word of possible human knowledge, was therefore carefully preserved. It preceded by long ages the Alexandrian theosophies, reached the modern, and will survive every other religion and philosophy. When is it preserved? And the answer is given, among initiates of every country, among profound seekers after truth, their disciples, and in those parts of the world where such topics have always been most valued and pursued, in India, Central Asia, and Persia. Then the question is asked, is theosophy a religion? And the answer is given, certainly it is not, since it is the essence of all religion and of absolute truth, a drop of which only underlies every creed. Theosophy on earth is like the white ray of the spectrum, and every religion only one of the seven prismatic colors. Ignoring all the others and cursing them as false, every special colored ray claims not only priority, but to be that white ray itself, and anathematizes even its own tints from light to dark as heresies. These clearly indicate to us how the mother source from which everything has come. Elsewhere, it should be clearly indicates, I think we'll first go to the religion of the third root race, perhaps that will help us to understand. In the second volume of the Secret Doctrine, it should be indicates what is the religion of the third and fourth races? In the common acceptation of the term, neither the Lemurians nor yet the progeny, the Lemuro-Atlanteans, had any, as a no dogma, nor had they to believe in faith. They didn't have any religion. They had one religion, humanity. No sooner had the mental eye of man be open to understanding than the third race felt itself one with the ever-present as the ever-to-be-unknown, the invisible all, the one universal deity. They were one with that. Endowed with divine powers and feeling himself his inner God, each felt he was a man God in his nature, though himself his inner God, though him an animal in his physical self. The struggle between the two began. From the very day they tasted the fruit of the tree of wisdom, a struggle for life between the spiritual and the psychic and the physical. At the dawn of his consciousness, he's talking about the infant humanity. The man of the third root race had thus no beliefs that could be called religion. That is to say, he was equally as ignorant of gay religious, full of pomp and gold, as of any system of faith or outward worship. It is the golden age in those days of old, the age when the gods walked on earth and mixed freely with the mortals. Since then, the gods departed, and later generations ended by worshipping their kingdoms, the elementals and the elements. This clearly indicates how the one right of truth was vulgarized and then made to branch off. In other places, it clearly indicates, defining in a unity pamphlet entitled, Is Theosophy a Religion? She says, very clearly, a religion, in the true and only correct sense, is a bond uniting men together, not a particular set of dogmas and beliefs. Now religion, per se, in its widest meaning, is that which binds not only all men, but also all beings. Re-legere, to bind back humanity into one whole. And all things in the entire universe into one grand whole. Then quoting Miller, she points out, true religion is always mild, propitious and humble, plays not the tyrant, plants no faith in blood, nor bears destruction on her chariot wheels, but stoops to polish, succor and redress, and builds her grandeur on public good. This is Miller. Then again she says, theosophy is not a religion, we say, but religion itself, the one bond of unity which is so universal and all-embracing that no man has no speck, from gods and mortals down to animals, the blade of grass and atom can be outside of it. Not even a blade of grass can be outside of it. Therefore, any organization or body of that name must necessarily be the universal brotherhood. Then the last quotation. She talks about, again, here she repeats, that this wisdom religion or theosophia has come down to us from the exalted spiritual beings of the third root race. And then she says, the unity of everything in the universe implies and justifies our belief in the existence of a knowledge at once scientific, philosophical and religious, showing the necessity and actuality of the connection of man and all things in the universe with each other. Which knowledge, therefore, becomes essentially religion and must be called in its integrity and universality by the distinctive name of wisdom religion. Then she says how the other various religions are branched off. It is from this wisdom religion that all the various individual religions, erroneously so called, have sprung, forming in their turn offshoots and branches, and also all the minor creeds. Every such religion or religious offshoot, be it considered orthodox, heretical, wise or foolish, started originally as a clear, unadulterated stream from other source. This is very important, that the prophets, once they leave the scene, the priests take over, and then pollution takes place. The fact that each became in time polluted with purely human speculations and even inventions due to interested motives does not prevent any from having been pure in its early beginnings. There are these creeds, but each and all are of divine because natural and true origin. A. Masteism, Brahmanism, Buddhism, as much as Christianity. It's the dogmas and human elements, the latter, which led directly to modern spiritualism. These clearly indicate to us the mother source is one. And what is the teaching of theosophy then? What does it say about the nature, deity and man? We don't have time to go into details, we'll just briefly enumerate. It talks about that it's the wisdom religion, it's the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It talks about both cosmogony and anthropogony. And she points out that even the cosmogony is so vast that it would have taken perhaps millions, thousands and thousands of pages to copy it on. But yet, the spiritual vision of the seers was such that they could record it in a few pages of geometric glyphs and signs. And this knowledge, yes, see, they were able to see it, the very kernel of things, not the outside circumference, but they were able to record things. And this knowledge, yes, was saved during the last cataclysm, shifting the cataclysms and continents, and it was passed on, first of all, you see, orally. But before passing it on, they learnt it themselves, and then passed on orally to individuals. Each individual tried to perfect himself in all departments of nature and tried to corroborate whatever his visions were with the visions of other people. Unless it was corroborated, it was not passed on. This knowledge, therefore accumulated thing, right from the third root race, have come down to us with an unbroken continuity of tradition without any pollution from human, due to human intervention. And this knowledge is called theosophia. It gives three fundamental propositions. Called God, law and being. Spirit, matter, mind. Now, it points out there is one universal eternal, immutable, imperishable, omnipresent principle in the universe. It rejects totally any concept of personal God idea. It says it's a universal divine principle which exists everywhere, which is beyond the range and reach of human thought. It is the, what is called Parabrahma or Paramatma. It's the ever-living, vibrant reality. All of us have come from that source because it's omnipresent. Then we are going towards the same goal. It is, as the Upanishad points out, is neti, not this, not this. It is one rootless root of all that was, it is, or shall be. It's called in Sanskrit Sat. And she explains to us that this can be understood in terms of two symbols. Absolute abstract motion, which represents consciousness, and the other one, absolute abstract space, which represents bare subjectivity. When you think about even space, even physical space, our mind reels. Can you have a boundary to space? We can't have anything. Anything we conceive of must be in space. I mean, it represents the bare subjectivity through which the ideation or the motion of consciousness passes through. And this, from this field of Parabrahmic consciousness, when you come down to the manifestation, we get to the plane of duality in terms of subject-object, spirit-matter, purusha-prakriti. In manifestation, what happens? These two are necessary. Spirit cannot manifest excepting in terms of vehicle of matter. Likewise, matter without the animating spirit would be absolutely an empty abstraction. But there is that which connects these two, which is technically called in Tibetan language, Poha. It is that intelligent medium behind manifestation through which the plan and the ideas in the existing in the divine mind are impressed in cosmic matter as laws of these. And this great deity, which is impersonal, universal, yes, this deity manifests itself in terms of law in the universe, the law of periodicity, the law of manifestation and non-manifestation, a period of manifestation for an equal period of non-manifestation in the bosom of the unknown. Now, this is so universal that we can see it in our daily life in terms of life and death, sleep and waking, night and day, ebb and flow of tides, the great law of karma, etc., etc. This one life which manifests in the universe, the great law that governs the universe. When applied to man, it becomes the law of karma, ethical and moral compensation, law of ethical and moral compensation. Therefore, what we find is the whole universe, there is one, unifying force, the unity of all things in the universe, which is imparted, which is whole, which cannot be divided, which cannot be fragmented, it is one reality, the homogeneity itself. That has two aspects, the polarity, subject and object. Therefore, every speck of matter is throbbing with life. This life, absolute life, becomes life in the universe. Therefore, every speck of matter is throbbing with life. Everything is sentient, conscious. Therefore, everything is organic. Organic simply means change. Anything that changes must be sentient, must be conscious. And then, she also points out, yes, this life becomes the law of karma, the law that governs the universe, the law which spells harmony not only in the spiritual world, but in the world of matter also. It's man, because of his thinking, disturbs the law. Now, she also points out that man mirrors the whole universe. He is identical in his spiritual nature and physical nature, not only with the whole universe, the Ishvara, the manifested Ishvara, but the absolute principle. And therefore, she says, look here, whatever that you are going to attribute to nature in terms of the manifested God, in terms of his forces, the faculties, the powers, all are inherent in man. If only we are able to summon up those powers by controlling our lower nature and allowing, really realizing this vehicle is a vehicle of Avalokiteshvara, the manifested God in us, then perhaps we can really become the God. The Godhead can be made manifest here. In more than one place in the Feet of the Auspicious View points out that when we are able to paralyze the lower, the higher can manifest itself uninterrupted. Now, from this, the whole evolution is there for the evolution and emancipation of man. as Patanjali points out. Therefore, she points out, look here, after the stage of man, the evolution proceeds to natural impulse. The moment you come up to the level of man, then his free will supervenes and the evolution in his own hands, and he has to proceed by his own self-induced ways and means. And this vast scheme of evolution, yes, right from the lowest of atoms to the mightiest of Brahmandas, is through a series of progressive awakenings, he points out. Now, the whole point is that the whole evolutionary scheme is to, for the production of, finally, the product should be the production of perfect man. And in the very process, because he is a part of nature, he is all of us, an emanation of the universal oversoul, going towards the same goal, she points out, all of us willingly are brothers. In fact, in one place in the glossary, while defining humanity, she says, humanity is a brotherhood by virtue of the sameness of material with which all of us are born. But unless it also becomes a brotherhood, intellectually, it's no better than a superior genus of animals. Very, very clear. But what happens is, unless we are able to realize that we are all brothers within it, brothers and sisters, emanating from the same source, going towards the same goal, with a great purpose, the purpose of life is to perfect ourselves. In the very process of perfection, we try to carry with us, yes, and raise the consciousness of every atom that go to make up our body to higher level states of consciousness, to realize the nature, stature, and dignity of conscience, Godhood. Therefore, the vast scheme of evolution put forth by theosophy is that unity of everything. Fundamentally, there is one, not two. Unfortunately, man, having been born here, being identified himself with Nama Rupa, the personality, thinks he is separate. And in the very process, he mistakes the unreal for the real, due to his ignorance of the real nature of things. What happens, unless you are able to realize that unity, you won't be able to appreciate the first object of the movement, namely to establish a nucleus for universal brotherhood. She points out that the first object, to establish a nucleus for a universal brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition or organization. The piece we have to shed all our labels that we attach ourselves, a Brahmin, a Christian, this, that and the other. These are all man-made labels. Can our soul have any color, any caste? So many people talk about today about Hindutva. Do they know what Hindutva means? One of the fundamental concepts of Hinduism, I mean, in fact, Hinduism is a later coinage, the Aryan philosophy, which is, yes, toleration. And then the late philosopher, Dr. Sarvalli Pada Radhakrishnan, defines toleration. Tolerance as the homage paid by the human mind to the inexhaustibility of the infinite. If that one reality is omnipresent, it must be everywhere, in all the so-called gods of other religions also. Then why do you fight with other people? Look at what the Ishavasya Upanishad says. Yastha sarvani bhutani atmaneya anupashyati sarvabhuteshu atmanam tato na vijigupchase. The translation is, and he who sees all beings in the self and the self in all beings, he never turns away from it. He feels no hatred by virtue of that realization. What do we do today? The same self shall touch in all beings, although it does not shine forth everybody. Even in Malaysia, untouchable. Can there be any untouchable? It shines equally in a dog, in a Malaysia, in other beings, in a sage, in ourselves. Then why do we differentiate between, yes, Shudra, the servant, the master, etc., etc.? It's all man-made divisions. Look at this. And he who sees all beings in the self, and the self in all beings, he feels no hatred. And the Buddha said, hatred is not by hatred, but by love. This is Sanatana Dharma. no hatred by virtue of that realization. Can there be any strife, wars, because of religion? Religion has lost its meaning. It simply means that which unites the whole of humanity and all beings in one grand whole. What do we do today in the name of religion? People take up swords to fight people. What crimes have we done? Innocent people and women are killed. Then the next verse says, when the self has become all things to a man, who knows what sorrow, what delusion can there be to him who has perceived his oneness? The same idea comes in the 6th chapter of the Gita also. The person who is beyond all sorrow and he is able to sense the unity enters into me. It's in my own words. And the Upanishad clearly points out, Tarati Sokam Atmavi. A person who crossed beyond the sorrow is one who has realized the Brahman within. All these are there, and yet we talk about Hindutva. Do they really know what they mean by that? It talks about unity, fundamental unity of all things. And the very first verse, the Ishavasya Upanishad, talks about that one. Give up, renounce all things. Nothing is ours. Even this body doesn't belong to us. We got it from Mother Earth. It's going to be consigned to Mother Earth one day. And we make so much fuss about it. Do we own anything? Not even our lives. The only thing that we own is that whatever that is consubstantial to our nature. Whatever else we learn in the school of life, yes, fade away at death. Only our noble aspirations, the higher thoughts of altruism, of service to other beings. That alone can form part and parcel of the immortal ego when it leaves this earth, realm of earth. But what do we do? All the time we are trying to accumulate wealth, we are after pleasures, without realizing there is a pleasure worth having, which is called by the Upanishads, Shreyas. Short-lived pleasure only we are after. If we are all the time trying to enjoy life, naturally pain will pursue. We are oscillating between pain and pleasure all the time. But the moment we are able to cultivate detachment, and then altruism, that moment we will be able to transcend the plane of duality, in the plane of unity, where alone we can sense the reality within. Then, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where the sage Yajnavalkya teaches his wife Maitreya and Gargi and also the Rajarishi Janaka, he says that Atmanastu Kamaya Sarvam Priyam Bhavati. He says, earlier to this, there are two or three shlokas which simply says, if you love your husband, it is not for the love of your husband. It is for the sake of the self in your husband. If the husband loves the wife, it is not for the sake of wife, but it is for the sake of self in her wife. Likewise, if you love property or wealth, it is not because of the property or wealth. It is because of the self that shines with that. Everything is bound together or brought together by the bondage of love. Not the mortal love, that compassion which must go out of our heart to all the views and breeds. And this is again clearly brought in the Gita, the 3rd chapter of the Gita, where it clearly says, Parasparam Bhavayantaha. Can we be alone anywhere? Can we be isolated, independent? If you sit on the breakfast table and you have your breakfast, do you realize how many lives have gone into that making of the breakfast tea? Right from the farmer growing wheat, the bakery who bakes the bread, and the delivery boy comes and gives it to your door, and the person in the house, your wife or servant who makes that. Do you ever reflect for a moment to say thanks to all of them? We take so many things for granted, this whole problem. Do you ever reflect, where's the whole power that animates us? In terms of even strife, in terms of peace, enlightenment. What is that power? It's the one source from which all things have come. The whole point is, it's unless we're able to see that, yes, that unity is there, that it's willingly, it's our duty to be of service to other souls. Loka Sangraha, this whole body, is a tenement where the Dehi resides, the immortal soul, in order to, yes, not only perfect ourselves, but to have serviced human souls. And this spirit of service and unity of knowledge are fundamental things, the expressions of a true religion. Unfortunately, we don't have the right knowledge to understand the substance of religion. We go on blind faith and become ourselves fanatics and bigots, raising swords against our fellow beings. The moment we are able to realize satyat nasti paro dharma, there is no religion higher than truth, and dharma is sattvatritam, ritha, or that truth itself. Can there be religion higher than truth? They can empty in falsehood. But what is true today must be true everywhere. 1,000 years hence, and 2,000 years back, whether it's in Timbuktu or Vladivostok. See, the whole point is, we are unable to appreciate that the divinity is here. We try to seek it outside. And that is why the Gita clearly points out, Atmanam Atmana Pashya. See the self by the self. Raise the self by the self. Unless we are able to perceive there are two natures in man, and the lower has to be conquered with the help of the higher. And Mr. Judge clearly indicates to us in the Epitome of Theosophy that this process of realization, however interior it may be, it is not unaided. The help, encouragement, enlightenment comes from within. It is the greatest source of strength inside us. The Master Ishvara, seated in the hearts of all beings. Take sanctuary with him alone, and thou shalt be delivered from evil. Then, we will close this with a quotation again from the Secret Doctrine to indicate to you that, see, when we say Theosophy is the mother source, you should not be mistaken or misconstrued that it's hodgepodge of all religions. It's not. She says, in the preface itself, it's perhaps desirable to state unequivocally that teachings, however fragmentary and incomplete, contained in these volumes, belong neither to the Hindu, the Zoroastrian, the Chaldean, nor the Egyptian religion, neither to Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, nor Christianity exclusively. The secret doctrine is the essence of all these things. Sprung from it in their origins, the various religious schemes are now made to merge back into their original element. That is where the importance of the demonstration of comparative study of world religions. You must be able to appreciate, yes, the truth underlies all these great religions, and try to get back that original source, out of which every mystery and dogma has grown, developed, and become materialized. We have a few minutes for your questions. So in fact, you see, this time is too short to give a comparative analysis of various religions. If a person goes to the Aishadhanvir, second volume, you will find a comparative table given by SVP regarding the universal ethics taught by Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, Buddha, and also the Jesus. Yes, time is not enough in one life, in particular one's life, to study all the religions, understand. First and foremost, this student humbly submits, but we should make a start somewhere. But are we thoroughly aware or understood what our own religion talks about? The student humbly submits, I'm only a student of some of the Upanishads. But so much given there. See, if we're able to, see, with the key that Theosophy provides, we can easily understand the various things. Of course, you can go to the Gospels and see what it says. St. John's Revelation is there. St. John's Gospel is there. And then even Quran you can take some of the, some of the old volumes of theosophy and theosophical movement contains some of the quotations from Quran. And in fact, there's a Bible of all these great religions available that can be read. Yes, time is short, but the point is you must make a beginning somewhere. As a student of theosophy, we have to undertake the comparative study. If tomorrow we have a lecture on Ramzan, we should be able to give. At that time, do we not go to some books on Quran and to prepare ourselves? Supposing a lecture is to be given on Jainism, what do we do? The whole point is, with the theosophical key that we have, that has been provided by HP people of ASCII, it must be easy for us to understand. Although, yes, it's time consuming. We must. Just like we allot some time for food to keep the body fed, then we must do something. The time, yes, the time we can always find time. The whole idea is, yes, the moment you are able to read and understand the various scriptures, you are able to see, yes, there is an underlying current about which HPB talks. Now we are only quoting what HPB has told us. But we don't realize that by going to the other scriptures. That's what we have to do also. Especially when you go to Upanishads and all that, you will find some of the great Upanishads, they don't have any idea of monotheism at all. It's not universal, universal self talking, they are talking about.